Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I am the creator of All Leather Must Be Boiled, the Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones blog located at boiledleather.com. I cover Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone, and I am the co-author of the official annotated A Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros.org and series editor Anne Grohl. And with me, as always, is my illustrious co-host,
Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog for all things nerd. It's called the Nerdstream Era, and you can check it out at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And we have one very special guest tonight, which is...
Hi, I'm Adam Feldman, and I blog at the Myronese Blot, and I'm a pretty new entrant into the Song of Ice and Fire blogging community, and happy to be here with these guys.
And you may be a new entrant into the blogging community, but you were quite the overnight sensation, I thought.
Oh, boy, yes.
I was wondering, you know, just to get things started off, as we talk about some of the ideas that you've advanced on your blog, how did you get involved in the fandom? How did you come across the books? You know, what's your origin story?
So I don't really have much of a fantasy, sci-fi fandom background, really. I think HBO is what got me into it. Actually, before the HBO series aired, when I heard that they were going to adapt these books and read a bunch of people praising these books to the skies, I was like, oh, well, maybe I should read these books. And I turned out to really love them. And so sort of since then, in the lull between A Dance with Dragons and awaiting the next book, I got involved in debating what the book meant, whether it was even a good book or whether it was a bad book. And in these discussions, I basically felt that I had some opinions on what the story meant that I felt very strongly about and didn't seem to be very widely shared. So eventually, 2 years later, I ended up writing them up in long essay format, which you can read at the Myronese Blot.
Now, the first big theory, the theory is almost not quite doing it justice, but I think the thing that obviously put you on the map, it was the first thing that you did, and certainly led to my own extremely enthusiastic endorsement of what you were doing, was the issue that gave your blog its title, the Myronese Blot, being a pun obviously on the Myronese Knot, which is George R. R. Martin's way of describing how difficult it was for him to write that section, but has sort of come to represent in the minds of the fandom the sort of morass of narrative threads and plot threads and thematic goings-on that take place centered on Daenerys' time in Meereen. And that's I found a very, 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 very striking and persuasive analysis of what Martin was doing in the books, because I thought you were tackling all different elements of the novel equally, sort of plot concerns, thematic concerns, character concerns, the way it's written, the aesthetics, the prose. I thought it was very, very impressive. And I was just wondering if you could briefly outline what you're thinking, you know, just... You had sort of a 5-point plan, if you will, as to how to approach that material, and I was wondering if you could lay that out for us.
Sure, I'd say my general approach in analyzing these books is pretty much based off of a quote from Martin, who himself is quoting William Faulkner, and he says it a lot in interviews. He says, "The only thing interesting worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself," and I found that if you keep in mind this quote when reading the books, and especially the more recent books, which are more psychological, maybe more subtle, less crazy action than the earlier books, you really, I think, see what Martin was getting at in setting up certain dilemmas for his characters and forcing them to make very difficult decisions between their values. And that's pretty much what I thought was at work in Meereen. So my argument essentially is that the point of Dany's plotline in Meereen is essentially to showcase her struggle with herself and she is tempted to use a path of violence and force and cruelty to get her way. And most of the book, she attempts to restrain this part of herself, which I argue is the metaphor of chaining the dragons. And then only at the end of the book, she sort of embraces her fire and blood side again and lets it out. But the layout of the essays was that I actually started with a more minor case, first of all, to sort of argue that what people thought that was going on in Meereen might actually be a lot more complicated than meets the eye. So there's this incident near the end of the books in the fighting pits scene when the Shave Pate, my argument is that the Shave Pate, who was recently fired by Danny's new husband, Hisdar, is in fact responsible for the mysterious poison locusts that show up in the fighting pits. And if that is the case, and obviously it's not proven, it's just my theory, but if that is the case, then it makes one wonder, well, if the Shave Pate was poisoning the locusts and the Harpy and Hisdar were innocent of that, maybe we should take a closer look at what at the peace deal that was agreed to, which most fans seem really, really down about. And so my argument there was that essentially that contrary to what most people think, both Hisdar and the Harpy appear to be actually committed to this peace agreement with Dany, that Dany herself is so down on, that many of the fans are so down on, and that if you actually look at the textual evidence, there's very little indication that they're plotting betrayal.
This is a really interesting point, and one that I, before reading your blog, I had never heard about. And I think it just makes such a large amount of sense, not especially regarding the plot. I think if you are going from what's the most logic assumption, you know, using this normal plot logic that people usually do when they watch Lost or stuff like that, that's not exactly the approach you have to take here, but more a thematic one, a narrative one. Mm-hmm. It just makes so much sense. I feel that these guys would honestly want peace, and that Dany had finally achieved it, and then she throws it all away because essentially she's on one hand tricked, and on the other hand she's just too impatient, too bound on violence, which certainly not coincidental, the fandom is too. And I think this is a really interesting meta dynamic, you know, the preparations of fandom on how the story should progress, and the preparations of Dany on how she should progress.
Yes, Dany becomes the sort of ultimate audience stand-in character, a person who's frustrated with the path of peace. The trick that Martin's pulling, Adam, as far as your analysis is concerned, is that he makes it seem like her frustrations are somewhat justified, that it appears as though the piece is doomed to failure, whereas what you're arguing is that, you know, were it not for the intervention of Drogon and betrayal by someone who's nominally one of her allies, like real allies, not like a ally of convenience like Hisdar or the other families, once the peace is achieved in the person of the Shave Pate, she actually might have been able to preserve the peace, you know, at great cost to her own happiness, and at the sacrifice of her drive to extirpate the slave trade and obviously conquer Westeros, but she had gotten a lot closer than perhaps it seemed.
Yeah, central to my argument is kind of that the ideas of peace and war in Martin's thematic treatment of them are a little more complicated than might appear on the surface. We've spent a few for Crows and much of the first three books dwelling on the horrible consequences of war at length, broken men, all of these, you know, terrible murdered and raped innocents. And I feel that in the fifth book, Martin shifts gears a little and starts to explore what is a peace. And sort of compare these imperfect pieces, which I don't want to oversell. There's a ton of horrible moral compromises Danny has to make this piece. She has to, as you said, let slavery continue outside Marine's walls. She has to marry, you know, a man she doesn't love, let a lot of the nobles get off the hook. She doesn't get everything she wants. She has to give up her dreams of, you know, creating a new world from scratch. But what she gets from it, I would argue, is the pearl beyond price, which is a quote from The Green Grace late in the book. The Green Grace argues that Barristan shouldn't break the peace because peace is the pearl beyond price. And I think the placement of that quote, I think, makes pretty clear how certain characters who even we think of as extremely sympathetic and well-meaning and good generally can choose to discard this peace for all these seemingly justifiable reasons and welcome a war, but then that war will have so many horrible consequences for the people who they're charged with protecting.
I find it really compelling because, you know, I think Stefan and I obviously both come from a politically progressive standpoint, and that's how we've approached this material since we started the podcast. And one of the things that Daenerys' storyline in Essos is often taken to at least evoke, if not be outright analogous to, is Western interventionism in the Middle East. The idea being, you know, that even if you grant the Western powers highfalutin rhetoric about freedom and democracy and human rights, in terms of that's their motivation for invading countries and meddling in internal politics of countries and things like that, even if you were to grant that, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, as it were. And, you know, intervening in an alien culture and an alien political system from your own often has all sorts of unintended and disastrous consequences. The interesting thing, I think, about your theory is that that still holds while, all this stuff flows from a consequence of Dany sticking her nose in, but it neither invalidates the fact that Dany is actually morally correct, that slavery is a horrible moral wrong, and it abrogates the idea that Dany is this sort of waffling, you know, that she becomes ineffectual, which I think is a big part of reader antipathy towards, you know, her arc in A Dance with Dragons. They just feel like she sits around and isn't doing what she's supposed to be doing, which is, I guess, kicking ass and taking names. It can sort of, the thing I really like about your master theory is that it can hold all these things to be true, that Dany is morally superior to the slavers, that it's still frequently a very bad idea to wage violent humanitarian interventions, that Dany is not necessarily the incompetent or the waffler that she seems to be. I like how all of that can work suddenly because of what you're doing here.
Yeah, I also like the argument that you make about the culture. You had this thing analyzed. The Dany, and in extension the reader, really dislikes this alien culture, this other culture, which is Eastern. You know, it has so many cliches, and that's a criticism that has been hurled at Martin from book one, I guess. That he otherizes Essos,
right.
And in Dany's dislike of this culture, and in her increasing willingness to risk war, basically over this alienation, he also, I guess, makes a point about the readership. It is maybe a bit too on the nose to say, but Martin's a bit trolling in Feast Dance, I guess, trolling his readers. You know, because these are all the desires that so many readers have. We want the battles, and finally Dany gets real and is on the blood path, you know, killing people left and right, going all Lady Stoneheart on Meereen. I don't know. So many people actually still think that this is a good development in any sense, where I, thanks to your analysis, basically, come more and more to this feeling of dread when I think about what will happen in the future. We get a lot of questions on the Supreme Court and how this will all play out. And since I've read your blog, I can really measure that my answers are getting way more pessimistic than they have been before, especially regarding on who's going to die and what the end game will be. You know, will the dragon survive? Will Daenerys survive? Will there be any political reform that leads to better people and stuff? I'm more pessimistic than ever about this.
Yeah, so essentially, in part four of my Untangling the Myrinese Knot essay, I call it a darker Daenerys with a question mark. And I argue that toward the end of the book, when she's in the fighting pits, and then later in the Dothraki Sea when she's on this vision quest, she embraces a path of fire and blood and of destruction, basically. And I pull out various quotes from the text, including, since the very beginning of A Dance with Dragons, when Drogon killed the little girl, Hazea, Dany has been trying to remember this girl's name, this innocent child who died because of her dragons. And she's been trying to sort of keep her darker impulses in check in memory of that child and because she thinks it's the right thing to do. And then in that final chapter on the Dothraki Sea, she tries to remember Hazea's name and she forgets it. She tells herself, I will never have children, only dragons. And this is in the whole other series of sort of vague, violent rhetoric in her minds. Viserys appears and tells her that, like, if I had the dragons, I would have shown the world the meaning of our words. And issues of prophecy come up. She sees Quaithi, who's telling her that a certain path is destined for her, and she starts to embrace this kind of thinking again. And then her final words in the chapter are concluding that Meereen was not her home, that she should never have stayed, and that it's the Harpy City. She'll never be a Harpy, and that her war is in Westeros. And her final words that she says are fire and blood. So all of this just seems to me incredibly ominous, and in particular, the forgetting of Hazea's name,
yes,
really does seem very symbolically important to me, that she is just embracing a new and much more destructive path. And a lot of her violence in previous books has been paired with some kind of moral cause. For instance, attacking Astapor and the other slaver cities. Like, she thought that she was doing this to free the slaves. And now she's going to Westeros, and there are no slaves in Westeros for her to free. I mean, this is straight up conquest that she wants to do. And conquest means death and destruction. And she's essentially willing to accept that now, I argue.
Yeah. Now, when you are just bringing up this whole temptation thing, in the whole course of Feast Dance, and especially, of course, A Dance with Dragons, we have the three characters that are widely seen as the three heads of the dragon: Daenerys, Jon, and Tyrion. And all of them are, in a way, on a darker path and are tempted by a different, very personalized temptations. And that is also a case you lay out, you know, John being tempted into this whole getting engaged in the Northern War, Tyrion getting tempted at a very ruthless try at Game of Thrones, stuff like that. Do you still think that this will all point to one a greater narrative about these temptations, and that all three characters will go down this darker road, or will Jon and Tyrion perhaps shrink back before the final aspect? We have seen that Dany now embraces fire and blood. We don't know how John will react to the assassination that he currently undergoes, and we don't know yet. I mean, it's basically a foregone conclusion that he will come back in some capacity. Yeah. And Tyrion, we also don't know how he will react to the Battle of Meereen and this defection of the Second Sons and stuff like that. So what do you think? Will they all three go down a darker path, or will this be restricted to one or two of them?
If I can just supplement that supplement that question real briefly, this is something that you and I have talked about briefly before. With regards to Daenerys, you know, given the, you know, I think the fairly obvious fact that she'll be a linchpin in the war against the others, and it seems like the weight of the narrative is pushing her towards Volantis and a massive, massive slave revolution there. You know, can we even be sure that her dark side will wind up being all that dark? So that's sort of as just a supplement to the question Stefan asked about the three of them.
Sure. Well, I'd say another quote that Martin uses a lot in interviews, when he's asked about good versus evil, he says, the war between good and evil isn't really fought on the battlefield. It's fought inside the human heart every day. And we know that Martin believes in at least some possibility of redemption for some very dark characters. So I definitely wouldn't go as far to say as, like, you know, they're all going to be evil or something like that. Our big three of Dany, Tyrion, and Jon. I think they're going to have to keep struggling with these dilemmas of values and innocent life and, you know, pragmatism and what's necessary to achieve what they want. But the arc for any of those characters could have numerous more twists and turns before the end of the series. So I definitely wouldn't say that the three are going to be villains.
No, I wouldn't go as far as that.
Right.
Dany, Sean, you said that she's going to Volantis, and this is definitely true. There seems to be an organic, homegrown slave revolution brewing there that she could help out with. And I never sort of attempted to argue that Dany will never do anything good again. But the other thing in Dany's near future that's been telegraphed is her going to war with Aegon. And it's very interesting, I think, how Martin has set this up, the prospect of Dany coming to Westeros. At the end of A Feast for Crows, Cersei was doing a terrible job. She had alienated the Tyrells. Things were falling apart for her. There are numerous quotes in A Dance with Dragons from Illyrio, from Tyrion, others saying that, you know, Westeros is ripe for conquest, for a savior. And then Aegon appears out of nowhere in the fifth book. He gets to Westeros first. And it seems that rather than Dany showing up as the savior to, you know, join with the Martells and overthrow the evil Lannisters and start, you know, some good, productive ruling, she's going to end up in this civil war with her alleged nephew that will, according to the quote from Teora Tolland in the Arianne Winds of Winter preview chapter, she had a dream that dragons were dancing, and everywhere the dragons danced, the people died. So it does seem like we're being set up for Dany's, she thought she would get Aegon's conquest, but instead she might be replaying the Dance of the Dragons, which we all saw how well that went for Westeros and the Princess and the Queen.
I don't think it's a coincidence that now that we've reached this point in the narrative, Martin's like, oh, I have 30,000 words to write about what it's like when dragons go to war, you know. I'm sorry, Stefan, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, just to clarify, I don't think that she will get all villainous or something. It's just this darker thing, you know, accepting more collateral damage and the like she was before.
Right.
Yeah, and one thing that I would throw out that isn't actually in the essays, but I've been thinking about lately is, so Sean, you said that Danny has been set up to, you know, fight the others eventually. But we've also, I don't think anybody would argue that against the foreshadowing for this Danny Aegon war. So it was interesting to me thinking about the character of Marwyn the Mage, who right now he knows all about the others and he is on his way to Danny right now, supposedly to show up early in the Winds of Winter. So the question is, if he gets to Danny and tells her all about this threat of the others, and yet the foreshadowing seems to be pointing to her fighting Aegon first. So is this sort of the next, you know, dark slash pragmatic choice that might lay ahead for Dany? She's been told by Quaithy that to go north, I must journey south. So perhaps if in this newfound embrace of prophecy and destiny, thinking about the Mummer's Dragon, she could very well hear about the threat of the others and then choose to go south first. Instead.
Right. Well, I mean, Slayer of Lies, that's part of the same prophecy that one assumes is building towards her eventual confrontation with the others. And that involves Aegon and Stannis and then a third party whose identity is not quite clear at this point. I actually have no
idea. It's just interesting to think about the purpose of Marwyn in the narrative right now. He's on his way to Dany, and he is the first character who will arrive in Dany's court with full knowledge of everything that's going on at the Wall and with the others. Right. So,
and he's a bit of a sinister.
Then why doesn't she go up there?
He's bit of a sinister figure himself, too, right? I mean, he is the person who trained Miri Mazdur, which hopefully he neglects to mention when he shows
up. It will be an interesting revelation, to say the least.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's an interesting thing about Danny versus John. John is aware of the nature of the true threat that exists for the realm, and Danny is not. Even to the extent that Danny is at a point where she's starting to consciously follow what she feels her prophetic destiny is, there's nothing in the prophecy that's telling her you're going to fight the undead menace, you know, at the north of the world. She reads it as, you know, you're supposed to be the queen. So when Danny finds out about the others and how and from whom and what, because I think another theory is that the wildlings taken captive at Hardhome might eventually find their way to Volantis and thus be available to testify as to the others and the whites and so on, directly to Danny when Danny arrives there, you know. So how she finds out about the stuff and who tells her and what they suggest and what she decides to do and how much credence she lends it, and, you know, that's all very much up in the air, and I think affects the rest of her moral program. You know.
Yeah, and the possibility that I was wondering about is Marwyn shows up, tells her about the others, as Tyrion shows up and is telling her about Aegon. And so sort of the question for Tyrion's character is, he's been to the Wall, he's heard of this stuff, and what advice does he give in this situation? He's the only person who knows anything about Aegon who's in Dany's court. So thinking about how that will play out in the Winds of Winter, it seems like that could be one of the first big moral choices faced by Tyrion.
Yeah, and
I guess it will also be another logistical clusterfuck for Martin, just to put out who tells her what when. You know, that's the second Myrinese blot.
Well, you know, this is, unless either of you guys had another point you really wanted to hit with Daenerys, I thought this was a good chance to shift over to some of the things, Adam, that you've written about Jon, and his decision to march forth against Ramsay Bolton at the end of A Dance with Dragons. This is a separate essay series that you've done, and a topic that Stefan and I have, I think, found ourselves on opposite sides of this particular debate over the course of our stalwart, otherwise stalwart friendship. you know, because John is the person, as we said, who is aware of the actual threat of the others, unlike Daenerys. But like Daenerys, he's in a position of authority. He needs to make decisions about peace versus war, about who constitutes his actual, you know, who are the people to whom he's genuinely responsible as a leader, or who are the people who are genuinely responsible to him as subjects. He has to make all these complicated decisions too, with the added menace of the others hanging around. And
yeah, and I think that that is, as you said, the key difference in how Martin has handled Danny and John's arc so far, which is that John is the person who's responsible for protecting the entire continent, perhaps the world, from this supernatural threat to the north. And the whole point of this watch, and, you know, they've declined a little bit in recent years, somewhat forgotten their purpose, but the idea of this greater duty that John has to fulfill in the continent from the others is, I think, really important to analyzing the difficult moral dilemmas that Martin presents John with in A Dance with Dragons. So essentially, I argued that John, in a position of leadership and in a position of great responsibility, protecting everyone from the others, also has these, you know, very noble and heroic desires to help individuals in trouble. And, you know, what we think of as a hero is someone who takes on great risk to himself, to protect the innocent, to rescue others, to right wrongs, and so forth. But John is in this unique position where he has this special responsibility that no one else has. And so he kind of has a responsibility to stay in that position and to ensure that that the continent is defended from this other threat, and that it isn't always moral, necessarily, I argue, for him to take on great risks to help individual innocents. So I think that this is a dilemma that occurs again and again in various forms in John's chapters in A Dance with Dragons. Very early on, he saves Mance's baby from Melisandre, even though he thinks to himself that he could be executed for doing this. Then, as we go on, Stannis is about to march into a trap at the Dreadfort, and John intervenes and tells him a better way to wage war in the north and save Stannis from certain defeat. And then we get the news that Ramsay has married Arya. And this, I think, is a little underanalyzed among a lot of people who are looking at John's arc, because several chapters in the middle of the book focus on how John reacts to this news about Arya. He keeps thinking that the Watch should take no part, and then Melisandre appears and starts to argue that, you know, he can have it both ways, that there's a way where he can save his sister without breaking his vows. And all he has to do is, you know, send Mance Rayder and a bunch of wildlings south, and that he can save Arya. And so in the final chapter of the book, skipping ahead, then we get the news that this mission, one way or another, no matter who wrote the pink letter or how much of it is true, there is a letter arriving at the wall exposing John's secret meddlings in northern politics and secret conspiracies with the Wildling King that he was doing to rescue his sister, and not for sort of in placing his greater duty at risk. So I argue that that decision to send Mance south is really important to John's arc in the book, and should really sort of shape how we view his conflict within his own heart.
No arguing for me.
No, I mean, arguing for me then, I guess. My argument regarding the decision to send forces south to fight against Ramsay is twofold. John's innermost thoughts are complex on this matter. I think more complex than some people give it credit for. You know, to be fair, it's not as though your analysis revolves, as many people's does, around the idea of whether John thinks that what he's doing is oath-breaking. You know, John's thought about it is that if this be oath-breaking, the crime is mine and mine alone, or something to that effect. So it's not even...
Yeah, and actually, I'm not even all that interested in the question of whether this is a technical breach of the oath, and more in, I guess, the larger question of leadership and the greater duty and how John's sort of well-meaning actions end up creating this this mess of a situation at the wall in the last chapter.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's arguably a complete and total disaster, and I don't even want to think about the bloodbath that's about to ensue between all those parties at the wall. My point, I suppose, even if you put the oath-breaking thing aside, is that I'm not sure if he was left much choice by Ramsay Bolton, knowing what he knows about Ramsay, and knowing what he knows about how what it's like to defend Castle Black against an attack from the south. Should Ramsay show up with the Bolton Frey forces in tow, he'd wipe them out. So, you know, John's attitude is like, well, better to ride out and meet them. That's if you give John credit that he's not just thinking in the heat of a moment, in the heat of the moment about his sister, which, you know, I don't know. It wasn't the heat of the moment in the sense that he did sit and talk to Tormund Giantsbane about what they were going to do for another 2 hours, which is breezed past in a single sentence in the prose, but not by them in quote-unquote real life. So, you know,
I don't think John really has any good options at that point. But I guess my argument is sort of more... My argument is that how he gets to that point when this pink letter appears and has suddenly ruined everything is that he himself has sort of chosen to go down this path by taking all of these risks, and that there are risks to the watch and the larger duty, and that people point out these risks to him frequently. You know, don't get too close to Stannis, because what happens if he loses? Or John himself keeps thinking about, you know, what if Stannis dies? Eventually, he starts to think less about this stuff, and he, you know, starts arranging marriages. He arranges the marriage with Alice Karstark and the Thens, and hands over a northern castle to them. And these are kind of surprising actions that I really don't think would have... let's put it this way. If the Boltons had heard that John had given Carhold to the Thens before that, then, you know, that something like this disastrous threat from Ramsay would have happened.
Yeah. Eventually. It's not like
the path that John was on just could not, like, he couldn't coexist with the Boltons, because he wanted to do all of these things. He wanted to save these people. He wanted to help Alice Karstark, and he wanted to, you know, integrate the wildlings. So,
I mean, John can come up with reasons that are persuasive to him, at least, to do all these things in terms of their being in support of his overall mission as Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. And I can even, you know, as Sean T. Collins sitting in my chair reading this stuff, can be persuaded by them. But it's worth considering that he is among what, you know, whatever else he is a political actor involved with other political actors. And it's not like Roose Bolton would be like, yeah, you know, I understand what you were doing with Alice Karstark. You're just trying to integrate, you know, the people of the North and the wildlings. That's cool. That's fine. I don't mind. Like, that's never going to happen.
You know, exactly.
None of Stannis's rivals, should Stannis be killed fairly definitively, and eventually somebody else schleps up north and looks around and sees what happens, like, that won't work out well for the Night's Watch. And we already know for a fact that, like, you know, Cersei is making plans to try and insert her own people in there because of what she's seen that he's up to. I mean, Cersei is that's not a rational action, but I mean, that's what's happening. That's what's happening. So he's in a difficult situation. I think the most persuasively incorrect thing he does probably is send a little fleet to Hardhome.
Yes.
Given the odds of their return.
I have a big section about that in my essay too, and I think that this flows from this larger question of how John reconciles his responsibilities for this greater duty of protecting the realm from the others to his desire to help individual innocents, and how much risk he takes on to help these innocents. So he's willing to send Man South with the six spear wives to try and save Arya. Like, that's a risk that he takes. He knows that it could go horribly wrong. His involvement could be exposed. The Boltons could retaliate, whatever. And then we get to Hardhome, where it's sort of a very similar situation writ large, where there's a risk, and John's driven by this desire to help all of these innocent people at Hardhome, which is a very noble and understandable desire. But the logistics of how he chooses to do that are borderline crazy, I think. He wins these extra ships from the Iron Banker, ends up with 11 ships in the Night's Watch's whole fleet, sends them all immediately up to Hardhome, all of them. When he hears that the ships aren't coming back, then he decides to send a huge portion of his own land force off of the wall, where they're, you know, protected and they have the high ground, through this insanely dangerous land path, and where he points out all the logistical problems with the mission in his own mind, but he never really doubts that this mission is necessary. He just feels it is, and he wants to do it. But, you know, in doing so, isn't he kind of putting the realm itself at greater risk by giving so many resources to try and help the people at Hardhome?
Right. And I understand that it's not just a matter of, like, being a do-gooder. He's concerned that when the people at Hardhome die, they will come back as enemy soldiers, which is true. But if he's throwing, you can't, at a certain point, this sounds horribly callous. I'm losing my good progressive points as we speak, but you can't keep throwing good money after bad. When he is sacrificing, you know, what little strength the Night's Watch actually has on these virtually guaranteed to be ill-fated rescue missions. I mean, certainly the one over land. I mean, Christ, that, you know, it's not like the others are sailing around in ships, so at least there's a chance that maybe they could effect an amphibious rescue by the fleet that he sends. But to send, you know, like a force on the ground through, you know, territory controlled by the others is just ludicrous. And at that point, it's not just that you're adding to the enemy forces. You're adding people that you are directly subtracting from your own forces. And then it becomes a lot harder to justify as best I can tell. I mean, it's awful. And like, as you said earlier, he's not left with a whole lot of good choices. But
I think it's a similar dilemma to what Danny faces in this question of, can I help everyone? And having to grapple with limitations and the reality that, no, you actually can't help everyone, and that your desire to, and that you're going to have to compromise to sort of help the people that you can help.
Right.
And that trying to help everyone, like in Dany's acceptance of letting the slave trade continue outside Meereen's borders, mm-hmm. she saw it accurately, I think, as the only way to pacify Meereen and prevent all this chaos from killing a ton of her own people. And that has cost for the people outside their borders.
And when you know, when the refugee camp is struck with the bloody flux, she closes the city gates.
Yeah, exactly.
She doesn't send out rescue parties to find all the healthy people and bring them inside or whatever.
Yeah, it's totally impossible. I mean, you can't even tell them apart, right?
Right.
But for me, the whole John issues that we just discussed, they are calling back to me to two things. At first, our very first podcast that Sean and I did together, when we talked about just the nature of John on the other hand, on the one hand, as the fighter for human rights, you know, mm-hmm. and Danny as the one who is leveling many hierarchies, except the one that puts her on top.
Right.
And I think that we see this again. John is, to an almost anachronistic extent, keen on preserving this, for him, sacred idea that every human has a right to live, that there is no distinction between humans. I mean, yes, he's fueled by the pragmatic desire to not add to the enemy ranks, but as you said, he's not acting rational in that. And this irrationality, I think, comes from his ideological bias. That sounds very negative. I mean, I admire him for his convictions, you know, but the thing is, he is in a position to make the hard choices. That's why he was elected, basically. That's his job. And it is, he botches it in the same way that the old bear botched it. And the other thing I'm feeling reminded of is one of the initial essays I wrote about this whole John storyline, where I said he's basically a shitty communicator. You know, he can't really get other people behind his ideas. He's not very good at making allies and convincing people of his positions. Many follow him regardless. I mean, look at Othel Jarwig or Bowen Marsh. Until his very treason moment, they follow him. They don't agree with him, but they are duty-bound and they follow his orders. And that's also why I think that the point about does he break his oath or not is a little bit more important than you make it. But be that as it may, It must have been obvious to him, or it should have been obvious to him, that risking so much on this rescue mission to the people in Hardhome that are, on the one hand, wildlings, and on the other hand, most likely dead already. I mean, he doesn't even know if they are still alive, and he wants to make this totally red-ass ranging there. So there are some serious issues that he needs to get under control and doesn't. And they are only magnified by the fact that he meddles in these northern affairs.
Yeah, and on the communication point, I did write about how, sure, John had no good options after the pink letter arrives. Yet what he does is actually quite shocking when you get out of his own head and try to imagine what everyone else must have been thinking, especially the Watchmen. So he reads out the letter. He says he sends the Watch to Hardhome under the command of Tormund Giantsbane.
Yeah, right.
He reads out this whole letter, which reveals that Mance Rayder is alive and that Jon had sent him to Winterfell to steal Ramsay Bolton's bride. He just reads this letter without, you know, rebutting it or anything like that. And everyone already thinks Hardhome is a suicide mission. And the imagery of Jon, you know, riding south to attack the Lord of Winterfell with an army of wildlings, it's just pretty amazing how Jon completely fails to anticipate and understand how the Watchmen will view these actions. And we know that he doesn't understand it, because when he is stabbed, he says why. He can't understand. He's completely shocked. He doesn't get it. And so when I wrote this section about the pink letter and John's response to it, someone left a comment which I thought was pretty funny. This is from Mike DC, who said, people on A Song of Ice and Fire forums talk a lot about the Targaryen taint when it comes to Daenerys, but she has never exhibited the sort of oblivious to reason that Jon demonstrates in his last chapter. I find it exceedingly strange that the John that does all the things he's done up to this point just suddenly loses his shit and announces to a hall full of people who hate each other a whole series of things that might make them go crazy and want to kill him and each other.
Yep.
I mean, even, and it's not even just the people in that room or the various forces involved. I mean, think to the Blackfish. The Blackfish thinks that John has betrayed the Starks. You know, so it's not just that he'll be leading an army of wildlings down from beyond the wall to attack the right, supposedly rightful Lord of Winterfell. He's Ned Stark's bastard son doing that. You know, obviously it's a little bit of a bastard versus bastard situation, and you kind of have to be a deliberate idiot to think that Ramsay Bolton has much of a claim on Winterfell. But, you know, disinterested parties looking at that situation, you know, might very, you know, especially given all, how all the northern lords more or less lined up behind the Boltons, you know, I mean, they're all at the fucking wedding, right? So, you know, when you look at that group of people, that as far as anyone else can tell includes, like, Wyman Manderly, versus, like, Ned Stark's bastard son, like, at the front of, like, a horde of, like, howling skin changers, like... That's like a terrible, like the optics of that, as they say in politics, are just horrendous.
I'm let down. And it sort of made me think about the thing that it most reminded me of was Rhaegar absconding with Lyanna, and sort of we don't really know the true facts of how that situation went down, but. You kind of see how Rhaegar, if Rhaegar is anything like Jon in this situation, you can kind of see how Rhaegar might actually have just disappeared with her and paid no attention to, you know, what anyone else would think about it or the terrible consequences that might happen because of that.
Yeah, yeah. Tut tut, Jon, tut tut, I'm disappointed.
And yeah. I don't want to sound like a John hater, as I've actually been accused of by some people, because what we didn't really talk about was his wildling policy in general, of integrating the wildlings, letting them pass the wall, and his general sort of good leadership and preparation for to face the others, which apart from, I think, these series of decisions which involve the affairs of the North and certain innocence and danger, John is actually quite a visionary and successful leader. And the moment when he welcomes the 3,000 wildlings through the wall, I think is completely central to Martin's, you know, the themes that he's pushing in this book, the themes of peace and how difficult it is to build, but how necessary and important it is because the horrors of war are just so terrible. So what I do find to be John's tragedy is that he is so incredibly successful at integrating the wildlings. It's been pointed out that, you know, a lot of people think that Bowen killed him because he let the wildlings through, but that doesn't make any sense with the timeline, whereas
yes.
He apparently does it days after the 3,000 wildlings are let through rather than right before. So if Martin intended to tell a story about John's, you know, failure to make peace between the Watch and the wildlings, he would have had that assassination attempt, you know, not after the pink letter and sort of Ramsay Bolton getting involved in this situation. So that's what points me a little bit towards these issues of, you know, war and peace and how John successfully builds one peace with the wildlings, but fails to create a similar situation with the North.
Yeah, and I think in all these cases, you know, people just simply may reach the end of their tether. You know, all these people who are making these decisions are likely exhausted by having made comparable decisions for months on end, you know, in horrendously stressful, violent, life or death circumstances over and over and over again. And you know, we see it sort of with Bowen Marsh, like, well, why did he strike now instead of before? Well, he got fed up. It might have taken a certain amount of time to marshal his co-conspirators and whatever, and this was the time was right to strike before John could leave, all that kind of thing going on. But, you know, everyone sort of reaches their breaking point, and I think maybe John just got to the point where the wisdom and the ethics with which he had been acting kind of start evaporating a little bit, just through overuse. And you could say the same with Daenerys. You know, she's throwing her traditional Meereenese garments on the ground before Drogon shows up, not after. You know, which is stupid. It's just stupid. You know, I'm sorry that you're fed up about the gladiators, but, like, that's a dumb, insulting thing to do. And, you know, moreover, as we've pointed out time and time and time again, is it really any more savage than trial by combat? No. You know, it's just the fact that this culture is portrayed as foreign to us, as sort of the inheritors of the medieval culture that Westeros is based on, doesn't mean that there are actually any... I mean, slavery is awful. Don't get me wrong. But, like, a lot of those, like, the gladiator, the fighting pits, like, you know, people just reach their point where they've had enough, and that can factor into decisions as much as any other, you know, more thought-through consideration of logistics and politics and ethics and philosophy and all those kinds of things that we're talking about. And that's one of the things that I like about these books, is that, you know, personal biases and personal emotions and feelings and, you know, that all is factored in what I think is a realistic and entertaining way.
Yeah. That sounds almost like closing statement.
Oh, hooray. Hooray for me. Adam, is there anything else that you wanted to add before we go?
I think that about covers it. Very much enjoyed talking with you guys.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming and speaking to us about this stuff. I really am a huge fan of yours, and I really relish the opportunity.
Likewise, to
pick your brain about it a little bit.
I mean, we talked about an hour now, and I think we could still talk at least three more and only scratch the surface.
Yeah.
This is just incredible how much is in there. Besides the usual, what does this prophecy mean, you know?
Yeah, you know, like, and I would actually make that point that I guess my closing statement would just be a defense of A Dance with Dragons as a whole, as an incredibly complex book with a ton of thematic meaning and subtle character development, moral dilemmas, just all these fascinating situations to analyze, which they're not like, it's very different from the first three books, which had a lot of battles, a lot of shocking twists, and I can understand why people were a little frustrated that Dance with Dragons and Feast for Crows had much less of that. But I think what they do have is just wonderful.
Right on. Well, thanks everybody for listening, and I hope you agree with us, as you should, as is right and proper.
We are so modest.
And Stefan, as always, good to talk to you too, man.
Thanks.
All right, see everybody next time. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.